Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to you all. This is the Business Day Spotlight, your destination for African business made simple. My name is Budiwa Gabaza, and for today, we are having a look at the banking sector. A number of the country's banks have recently reported, some of their earnings and, financial results. And we want to maybe take a look as a little bit of a pulse check, to say what do, those banking results tell us about where the country is, where the economy is, and perhaps anything else that can be gleaned from that. So to help us is a friend of the podcast, that is Ndumiso Kubeka. He is chief economist over at KH Equity Partners, and we're just going to get a sense of what's going on out there. Ndumiso, banks, right now, when you talk to portfolio managers, they often look at them and say that this has been one of the more resilient, industries in South Africa. And at a time when people are trying to strike a more positive note about the prospects of the SA economy, financial services and banking in particular is one of the sectors that people look at to say, this is where, some of that potential growth is going to come from. Your view, on that particular point?
No, certainly, Modiwa, and thanks so much for having me. For the South African economy in particular, the banking sector has shown to be quite crucial in terms of being able to withstand some of the headwinds that the economy has faced in the past, particularly when it comes to being able to service consumers and also businesses, and in particular SMMEs alike. And I think even historically, the idea of credit extension has been highly correlated with the growth of economies around the world. And in the South African environment, we've seen as a result of the sophisticated prudential mechanisms that the banking sector is under, we've seen it being able to maintain, satisfactory capital adequacy ratios. It also helps us to understand, in terms of a pulse check, of what is really the health of the South African consumer. Over the last 2 years, we've seen really sticky inflation and sort of elevated levels of interest rates. At some point, we were asking to what extent are we going to start seeing that come through credit impairments. And we've sort of seen that with most of the banks that coming through, the higher for longer interest rates have certainly had that effect. But we've also seen interesting improvements with some of the cost, management and operational efficiency measures that some of the banks are undertaking to really improve the servicing of their clients, which I think is a quite interesting dynamic in terms of what more can it be done, particularly, I think, when it comes to the question of reforms in South Africa and the big question around where will growth come from?
In answering that question around where growth is going to come from, one of the things that I'm quite curious about, and banks, I'm just wondering if banks have a role in terms of actually financing some of that growth. And I say that because risk appetite over the last couple of years has not been very high. Understandably so. I mean, we were in a tough economic moment. You've got high borrowing costs, high inflation, and coming off of COVID-19, risk appetite is not where it used to be. So do you sort of see some of that sentiment turning? And outside of that, do you think the country's banks have, the balance sheets that can actually support, some of that activity?
I share the same sentiment. Certainly, the risk aversion that has been associated with financing has certainly been there, particularly because of, some of the divergent geopolitical risks that has been affected the South African economy in particular. What I do think has changed, and that is a massive opportunity for the banking sector, is the tone in terms of at a policy level from government in particular. In the budget of this year, for instance, we saw pronouncements that the Minister of Finance had made around strengthening the public-private partnership framework in South Africa, enabling greater investment in key infrastructure projects in the South African economy. That, I thought, was an acknowledgement of the role of private sector capital playing a role in unlocking the, or answering the question around where will growth come from in the first instance. We've also seen, I think, a follow-up on that with the medium-term budget policy statement, where there's now a piloting of a credit guarantee program, which seemingly is a follow-on of the IPP program and leveraging private sector capital for independent power producing projects, and now extending it to the question of the transmission capabilities of some of these projects and the extent to which private sector capital can play there. And so I think there's a massive role that banking can play in terms of aiding and accelerating these structural reforms, particularly in what has been described as network industries in the economic reconstruction and recovery plan. So I think I see that as a massive opportunity. And even with the results from SASFIN and African Bank and some of the other banks, some of the moves that they're making there seems to be quite interesting for me. Because the acquisition around a business banking lens from an African bank perspective, to me, it suggests that they are seeing opportunity in the SMME market, but also in terms of their commercial business, because historically, that has not been a big focus. It has been more on the consumer end. And I think that, from an SMME perspective, can offer great opportunity in terms of, you know, entrepreneurs and SMMEs that are looking at exploring catalytic projects and maybe having creative ways in innovating financing solutions in light of now a greater appetite for public-private partnership, which I think becomes an important anchor for really continuing to answer where will growth come from, and trying to avoid anemic growth, the 2% range consistently, as opposed to really higher growth levels that can create jobs and absorb a growing workforce in the South African environment.
You know, Ndumiso, it's interesting that you bring up funding, especially around your SMEs and that type of thing, because a propensity towards, prudence. I think those are the words I'm going to use. when it comes to small businesses, appears to have opened up an entire cottage industry around what people would call alternative lending, because the banks haven't always, played nicely with some of the smaller businesses out there. So you now have all of these different businesses that are scoring on what they call alternative metrics and all of that stuff. And I guess what's interesting to me about all of that stuff is that in some of the cases, the money actually originates with the banks, ironically enough. And I just wonder if there's an opportunity to actually increase activity in some of that space as well, because you've got the alternative SME lending. You could also potentially club what you call this venture capital somewhere in that, in that arena. Do you anticipate that, those types of businesses continue to flourish, or may we see banks also, wanting to get a little bit more involved, in that type of thing?
You raise such an instructive insight there, Mudiwa, because we've certainly seen growth in terms of the alternative investment space in instruments such as private debt, for example, and venture capital, and I think in that alternative investments market, that has sort of created a case from a risk perspective, particularly for the banking sector, that actually there's a portfolio that can actually be tapped into. And the question then becomes, based on the risk appetite of a bank, to what extent do we want to eat some of that share and of that growth in that particular market. And I think for developing countries like South Africa and all emerging markets generally, it's a key opportunity for the banking sector to really capture that market, given the case that has been established by the alternative investments sort of portfolios that we've seen over time. And I think it's an important case that the sector needs to really pay close attention to, because in a developing economy context like ours, with the nuances that we see on the consumer side, and of course in terms of catalytic project side, it will require very innovative financing instruments to be able to really unlock value for shareholders, but at the same time to also address the socioeconomic issues that are persistent in terms of our policy making considerations. So that I think is a massive opportunity that banks and the banking sector needs to take advantage of, and really need to think in creative ways around how they can be able to really create sustained value in a way that makes sense for them.
All right, cool. I want to switch back to the actual results themselves, you know, to maybe get a broad sense. Obviously, we've spoken quite a bit about risk appetite, but in the current realm that we are in, from what you can see, right, who's actually doing well? You've got your established banks. Some would say Big Four. Some people would say Big Five. You've got some of the neo banks that have, you know, been making a lot of noise on the scene. But you've also got some of the smaller banks in the arena. You mentioned Sasfin earlier. There's also African Bank and others. So as far as you can see, on a relative basis, of course, because obviously your First Rands and your Standard Banks are going to shoot the lights out in terms of, you know, revenues and all that. But in a relative sense, who's actually doing well as far as you can see?
I think with some of the results that we've seen, I mean, you've mentioned, you know, what I referred to, some of the Big Fours, of course, and traditionally we already know where their focus areas are, particularly when looking in a very volatile sort of context, more on the secured lending front, so as to ensure that some of the impairments don't adversely affect, you know, their balance sheet quite significantly. And of course, the Big Four tend to focus specifically in their traditional areas where they know that they have a consistent market share and one that won't necessarily destruct shareholder value in particular. On some of the smaller bank side, certainly African Bank continues to be an interesting one, especially with the M&A activity that it has been undertaking quite recently, which is quite interesting to an extent around looking more on the commercial side as opposed to the traditional consumer lens, whereas you'd see with some of the other Big Four banks, the traditional lens would be more on focusing on secured lending and having a decent appetite from an unsecured lending consumer side. And so that balance has been quite consistent from a Big Four lens point of view. I've seen some of the smaller guys have a slightly more better sort of risk appetite in terms of seeing how they can unlock more value in the market. And some of the activities that we see from an M&A point of view, I think, is illustrative of that point. The competitive edge with these banks, I think, in the South African environment is really the extent to, you know, previously we would have conversations around, you know, underbanked customer base or unbanked customer base. But now the shift in language and conversation around underbanked and underserviced. So that goes to say, you know, you and I, who at a consumer level, at which levels are we underserviced from the banks that you and I use? And maybe at a commercial level, in what ways are we underserviced? Which I think it really triangulates to the point that you were making earlier at a commercial level around the case that has been presented by the alternative investment sector and the extent to which it presents opportunities for the banking sector to eat some of of that pie in that particular arena, which overall I think it presents an important competitive environment for South Africa's banking sector, because a growing economy certainly needs to be embedded in a strong banking sector, particularly from a prudential authority point of view, and also deep capital markets, to the extent that, you know, we have well-regulated, diverse instruments that, when well put together for projects, can really create catalytic growth. And so I do think that is an important space for you and I, both at a consumer level and also at a commercial level, when it comes to the moves that we're seeing some of the banks making currently.
Yeah, this issue of risk appetite is a very interesting one to watch and observe. I remember I was in India about this time last year, and one of the more interesting pieces, we were visiting technology businesses and venture-backed businesses. And in India, there's almost a rule that says that your banks, you know, cannot be investing in some of these risky asset classes, you know. So that's when you see an outsized, you know, investment pool coming from outside of India to invest in your, in what you call this, in your startups. So I find it, you know, interesting that traditional banks in many parts of the world, you know, still take a conservative approach when it comes to a lot of things. And even I keep hopping on about venture capital because it's a space I look at a lot, and I see the influence of banks' risk appetite, you know, on that particular sector specifically, because your venture capital space has been criticized of being more akin to private equity in South Africa than venture capital, because your origination is the banks. So the risk appetite of your venture capitalist is going to be precedent on what the banks are willing, how much rope the banks are willing to actually give these guys. So what do you call this? It is, you know, quite an interesting one to watch. But maybe tied to risk appetite in a sense is efficiency, right? As far as you can see, who's efficient in the market? I had a very interesting conversation on this platform recently about Capitec. There's one of our colleagues who recently wrote a book on Capitec, and he was saying that Capitec is ruthless about efficiency, and they will unlikely enter any market if they can't, you know, eke out some type of inefficiency edge. You know, so, you know, your thoughts just around who, you know, efficiency in the market.
I think you've quite correctly mentioned a Capitec. They've demonstrated, of course, the efficiency from a cost and operational management point of view. Standard Bank has also been quite consistent and efficient in focusing on that and ensuring that there aren't inefficiencies at an operational level that then sort of destructive value in terms of overall earnings. Some of the other banks seemingly are struggling a bit. You know, when you look at some efficiencies that we can see from a Nedbank point of view, there's opportunities there, but it's also informed by, you know, the risk appetite statement from that particular bank, and of course the sort of the direction that comes from the board, informed by shareholder inputs. And so that's where I think we've seen some key efficiencies. I'm quite interested as well in terms of the I understand some of the banks, the movements that we've seen. Access Bank is now, of course, in the South African market. I'm interested to see the play that they're looking to sort of make in terms of market share in that regard. African Bank, of course, is looking to offer an initial public offering around 2027. And I think efficiency becomes an important key factor there. We've seen, I think, since 2021, them making significant improvements, both from efficiency levels and even things such as net promoter scores, all of the things that really make a good offering for a sustainable bank. And so those are some of the banks that I think are making important moves in terms of ensuring that efficiency is not compromised overall. On the risk appetite thing, I think it's really the name of the business where banking is concerned. And where I personally see an opportunity to not only reduce the risks that are associated with specific transactions, is really from a policy statement point of view, what has been coming out in terms of addressing South Africa's structural reform issues. Prior, we haven't seen such of an appetite as we've seen now with respect to public-private partnerships. You know, some of the key things around the public partnership framework, which I see as valuable, is, for instance, the idea that if you, Modiwa, you have 2 billion rand that you want to invest maybe in a water project in the north or the northwest or the Northern Cape, you no longer have to go through 4 or 5 hurdles from National Treasury in order to get approvals for that particular project. That reduces risks that are associated with the time leads in terms of project completion and when we can actually start making money. That, I think, is important in reducing the risk appetite, both on the venture capital space and ultimately alternative investments, but I think also for the banking sector broadly as an important input. And I think those kinds of reforms will continue to play an important part in, you know, increasing the appetite from a banking and lending point of view, but also just generally in terms of the capital markets, both traditional banking and, of course, alternative investments or alternative financing.
When it comes to outlook now, there seems to be a lot of positivity in the market. I attended a presentation recently, a brief one, by the economics team at Standard Bank, and they have a positive outlook on, you know, South Africa and I guess the economy as a whole. My colleague Lindiwe Tsobo reported that First Rand is bullish that its operational and financial performance, at least in this current interim period, is going to be good even despite a challenging macroeconomic environment. They actually put out a voluntary statement earlier this week saying the SA economy as well as that of its broader African jurisdictions and the UK had remained largely as expected. And then they said the strengthening of the rand to levels higher than expected was likely to affect foreign exchange earnings from its operations outside SA. But in essence, they are, you know, quite upbeat about their performance as well. So yeah, I guess just thinking around some of that positivity or that sentiment right now that's amongst the banks, do you think it's warranted?
Sure. I think a lot of that sentiment is, of course, attributed to what was previously seen as a potential risk after our elections. And of course, it's almost common cause now that the government of national unity was well received in the markets in terms of the stability that it can offer. But I think even the internal competition in the operations of the running of government between political parties, which you and I would, the hope is that we potentially have positive, you know, implications in terms of efficiencies in terms of the running of government. So I think that's at the level at which the markets have sort of received that. The strengthening of the rand has also been attributed to some of the events that we've seen globally. Of course, the Middle East continues to be a risk area for the most part, and the extent to which flows affect that environment has an effect in terms of the performance of the rand. The US elections have certainly gone and passed by, but we've also seen a slight depreciation of the rand after the US elections, but the rand continues to sort of try to strengthen even post that normalization of those particular events. The central bank is consistent in terms of its target range from an inflation point of view. We're starting to see some of the benefits in terms of the stance that they've taken in terms of entering the rate cutting cycle, which we would anticipate that can be sustained over a period of time, provided that there aren't any upside risks on the inflation front. So I think all of those factors play a role in terms of the outlook looking into 2025. Growth continues to be a key concern, still relatively below 2%. And my biggest key, area of thinking around the growth question is 2% is more of an achievable target in terms of economic growth in South Africa in light of these prevailing conditions. The question becomes, how do we translate a 2% and step change it to a 5%? And I think some of these reforms are quite crucial in enabling that. Because not only from a growth point of view, economic growth point of view, but also from an employment growth point of view, it becomes quite important. The banks then enjoy the spillover effects of that from a disposable income and discretionary spending point of view. When banks look at it in terms of net interest income, it's important when it comes to shareholder value where that is created. But also in terms of non-interest income in some of the operations of the bank, that becomes quite an important consideration in terms of the strengthening of South Africa's banks' balance sheets and the management of the cost-to-income ratios that are associated with that. And so that's the context within which I think the optimism is located within, and some of the areas of growth and further growth and opportunity that I do think needs to be optimized by the banking sector.
You know what? I'm going to ask you what is probably an unfair question, but I'm just going to ask it anyway. Do you think there is, where we are moving, the current economy that we're in, and I guess the future one that we are moving into, this is a number of countries are struggling with this, and I just wonder what your view is on South Africa, because it has an impact on banks, because at the end of the day, the more people that are employed, the more people that can bank, the more services they will use, etc., etc. But do you see continued economic growth in South Africa necessarily resulting in jobs growth?
So I think that's a major question, particularly at a labor market policy level for many countries, but I think for South Africa in particular, given the fact that the South African economy, for a developing economy, it's relatively diverse, but it's still anchored around commodities. So a lot of our foreign exchange earnings, we derive that from the commodities that we export. And with an introduction of some of the mechanizations in specific industries, be it in the automotive industry and some of the developments that are taking place there. I mean, the National Association of Automobiles this year in 2024 had released some results around the period January to April 2024, when comparing that to January, April 2023, or is it March? But the first quarter, an 83% increase in electric vehicle sales. Although the volume is low, but the percentage growth is notable. So some of those changes, I think, when you're relating it in terms of employment growth, it raises important considerations around when we're looking at the value chains, where do those opportunities lie? And I do think that there are significant opportunities when, from a supply side point of view, we need to think more around the skill inputs that are important for an electric vehicle's value chain, for example, all the way from the extraction of that minerals and, of course, the input costs into specific products, be it the laptops that we're using, an electric vehicle, a phone, and so forth. So that, I do think South Africa, I see it as a significant opportunity in terms of a redesign of value chains and the extent to which labor market policy needs to be able to enable that. And of course, it must be linked to what wage growth also should look like in that arena. So an ecosystemic approach in the diversification of the South African economy becomes quite important, and not to look at one sector in isolation to another, because given where we are going, as you've outlined, all of these sectors are interrelated, and the availability of skills to an extent has to be interdisciplinary, as opposed to, you know, just look, I'm just for 20, 25 years, I've been a mechanic. But now the question is, to what extent can you, you know, step change your skills from being a mechanic to having insight in terms of the operations of an electric vehicles and other devices that operate with other softwares, for example. So the interdisciplinary nature of the skills requirement becomes a base within which South Africa needs to look at the future of growing and diversifying its economy. That's, I think, is a critical imperative in my view going forward.
Yeah, it's a very critical, what you call it, it's a very critical point. I'm talking to you on a day when I attended a presentation around the growth of gig economy work in South Africa, because it sort of highlights the fact that I guess permanent employment, or that, or that paradigm, is not what it used to be, you know, back in the day. And I think over time that's gonna have, when people, they call it gig work, but we're basically talking contract work, whatever name you want to throw on it. I think it's going to have an impact on, I guess, our definitions of employment going forward. What is a job? What is a proper job? At what point does it count, you know, in the statistics? If Ndumiso is an economist slash photographer and slash DJ, you know, is he counted three times in the stats, you know, or do we count, I guess, his main source of income? And especially this Gen Z, I might be going out on a limb right now, but you know, when you look at the trends and, you know, how many people are taking on that extra work and all of that, if someone doesn't have a 9-to-5 but has a bunch of things that they are doing, you know, are we going to be counting those people amongst our employed stats? So once again, a little bit of a tangent, but I am just looking at it and just wondering what impact all of that stuff is going to have on those national statistics and all of that. But when I link it back to banks, one of the things that I've noticed is, in certain cases, banks even struggle, you know, to classify some of these people. And you see it when you are applying for certain types of lending products, let's say a home, right? They'll look and they'll be like, what are you doing actually, right? What is the reliable income that we can assess this lending application on, right? And I guess one piece after another, I feel like it all feeds in, you know, to this thing that you know, that I'm looking at. But you can tell me whether you know, I'm being too extra right now.
No, I think you're raising interesting dynamics that need to be considered at a statistical level in terms of counting, you know, employment data, and even just thinking around it from a banking sector lens. Oftentimes the thinking is around, what is more important? Is it the number of bank accounts that of new bank accounts that are being opened on an annual basis, or from a quality perspective, is the extent to which those accounts are active in our environment? So, for instance, we've seen, you know, some of the banks and even some of the digital banks increasing their numbers quite significantly recently, Time Bank, for example. But the question then becomes, what is the quality of activity and transactions in that? You know, and Ndumiso, who's an economist, is he getting his earnings via that bank account? His DJ earnings, is he getting those earnings via that same bank account? His photography earnings, getting them via that same bank account? And I think the account quality, income quality, becomes quite important in those measurements. For a Time Bank having a significant number of accounts that are being opened versus, you know, an African bank, 2021, 1 million accounts to now over 5 million accounts, that are, the quality is people are banking and trading in those particular accounts. So with the shift in, you know, labor trends, I think that becomes quite important for the banking sector as well, to say, look, opening a whole host of banking accounts is, I don't think, is the most important measure. I think between you and I, Mudiwa, we definitely have more than one banking account. So I think given, you know, and Dumiso, who's a professional and has two or three other occupations, from a banking lens, the competitive edge is how do I ensure that I bank Dumiso at a consumer level, and how do I ensure that I bank Dumiso at a commercial banking level in terms of his photography and DJing preoccupations. I think that's where the competitive edge is, particularly in a very competitive landscape, and even in instances where we have a tough macroeconomic environment, as we've seen quite recently, when there's limited discretionary income, you would want to ensure that you fully bank the customers that you currently have working with you, which I think becomes quite an important one in light of the labor market evolution that you've highlighted earlier.
No, definitely. So we've actually, you know, covered, you know, quite a bit of ground in this discussion, talking about what's happening in the banking sector, but using that as a lens through which, you know, to maybe have a pulse check on what's happening in the broader economy. What do banking results or activity in the banks tell us about, you know, the state of the South African consumer, the state of the South African economy itself? And, you know, very interesting, you know, to see, you know, the bullish sentiment that's coming through from the banks at the moment, and you know, them communicating, you know, that they are looking you know, forward to increased growth you know, in South Africa, because when the economy is doing well, your financial services sector is going to do well. Talked quite a bit about you know, I guess the role of the banks in accelerating some of that economic growth, what the risk appetite is going to be. And I think risk appetite became a big thing that we focused on through this conversation, because there's so much that feeds into it. We talk about small businesses, them being engines of growth, but you know, are they going to get the support of the banks, or do the banks continue to have, you know, a somewhat of a dovish stance when it comes to, you know, how they look at that particular sector, alternative lending and all of those cottage industries that have, you know, popped up, and also, you know, giving us some insight into some of the things that have helped to push up sentiment, the fact that the GNU experiment has actually turned out, you know, better than expected, you know, so which is actually helping to spur some of that positivity. Obviously, things such as improved power delivery from the likes of Eskom and logistics are all feeding in to that, you know, that to that positive outlook. And then ending off there, yeah, talking about you know, some of the neobanks, the banks themselves, some of their appetites, the things that they do and do not do well, and what that entails going forward. Dumiso, have I missed anything, or is there anything else that you know, you want to add before we let you go?
No, certainly. I think you've quite succinctly highlighted the key discussion points that is really located within some of the banking results that we've seen, and some of the activity plays that are being made. And I think we've even touched on how these macroeconomic effects actually, you know, spill over into banks, and the enabling ways in which banks can be able to sort of spur further growth, particularly with the big question that both emerging markets and developed economies are asking: where will growth come from? And so I think we've certainly done that on this front.
Excellent. And that's how we round up today's discussion. And we were in conversation. Thank you so much to Ntumiso Kubeka. He is the chief economist over at KH Equity Partners. Ntumiso, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Dio.
And that's been it for this edition of the Business Day Spotlight. Remember that you can find our latest podcast on Business Live. That's under the podcast Business Day Spotlight tab on Twitter with hashtag BD Spotlight. And remember that you can review and subscribe for free on iono.fm, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, or wherever you choose to get your pods casted. Thank you to our amazing team. I've been Mudiwa Gavaza of the Business Day and Financial Mail. And this has been another edition of the Business Day Spotlight, which is a multimedia live production. So, for myself and the rest of the team, it is a good evening, good afternoon, and good morning.